Blog Talk Radio.
Imagine a friend has just told you they were diagnosed with a mental illness. What would you do? Awkward, isn't it? But what's even more awkward is, if you're not there for them, they'll be less likely to recover. Mental illness. What a difference a friend makes. To learn more, go to whatadifference.org. This message is brought to you by the Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for listening. If you started off at 11 a.m., we were speaking about a soundtrack for a revolution with Oscar-winning director Bill Guttentag. And right now we're moving on to mental health. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I think it's such an important issue. Many people try to avoid it. As a parent, I have a child, and you know, you worry about your children, and there's so many children who are suffering with mental health issues that aren't able to get help, especially minority children in urban areas. And so today we're going to be talking with three wonderful experts who've been working with studying children and helping find resources for children. One of the experts, Dr. Gary Blau, will be on. Dr. Sherry Malek will be on, and Ivan Juzang will be on. I believe they're on the call right now. Good morning, yeah. Ivan.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, this is Joy Keyes. You're on the air.
Thank you, Joy. How are you doing?
I'm good. I want to check in. I think we have Dr. Blau and Dr. Malek on. Good morning, Dr. Malek.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thank you so much for joining the call this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we got one more caller. Good morning, Dr. Blau.
Good morning. You can hear me?
Yes, I can. I can hear everyone. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Very well.
Thank you so much for coming on. I think this is a very, very important show. I mentored children for several years at the University of Pennsylvania, and I just am very passionate about making sure that children get the help that they need. A lot of people are not aware of what to look for and the signs. What is a mental illness? How do we define a mental illness? Because what's a normal behavior in one culture may not be the normal behavior in another culture. Dr. Blau, I want to open with you. How do you define, you know, what a mental illness is, or how do you say that this is a mental illness and not just normal behavior?
Well, I think that, you know, the first thing is that most people do experience, you know, mental health challenges throughout their throughout life. At any given time, we've estimated, based on some of the prevalence data, that about 20%, particularly 20% of young people, may be experiencing some kind of mental health challenge. And of that, probably about 10% are experiencing a mental health challenge that is very significant, that really impacts their functioning. And, you know, for example, a youngster who is very angry all of the time, or, you know, a lot of the time, or cries, overreacts to things, feels very anxious, extremely fearful, lots of worrying, you know, kinds of stuff, really sad. You know, so you go into all of these different things and you think about the stuff that really can bother a young child or, you know, a teenager. And does that go from just sort of being blue, if you will, you know, into an idea of some kind of a serious problem like depression or anxiety, those sorts of things? And really it's a matter of the parent and you know, asking the right questions to see if it begins to impact the child's functioning at home and at school, then you might want to be able to check it out.
Yes. Well, Doc, Ivan Juzang, you work with Me Productions Incorporated, and you recently did a study talking with some children in the hardest-hit neighborhoods in America, and one of the things that you found was that many of them are angry and have low self-esteem, and they felt that they have few positive role models. Talk to the audience about your project.
It was a two-year project focusing on urban trauma that low-income African-American youth and young adults experience on a daily basis. And it really focused on trying to understand what were the main stressors in their lives and then how they coped either negatively or positively and what enabled some young people in the hardest hit communities to thrive while others just survived. And so it was research conducted in four cities, Philadelphia, D.C., Chicago, and Oakland, California, in low-income communities where the per capita income was under $25,000 a year.
And some of the things that you talked about in your study were some of the resilient kids, because that's amazing. You know, there's kids that are in bombed areas. There are kids that are abused, sexually abused. There are kids that are not being fed or neglected, and they're still surviving. Where does this resilience come from? Dr. Malik, maybe you can help me out with this one. Where does the resilience come from?
I think it can come from another number of areas. Some kids have really good surrogate parents, or what in the African-American community people call kinship fictive kinship, so that people will be, you know, everyone has play aunts or aunties or uncles or grandparents or godparents who also look out for kids. And we also know that kids who have really supportive peers, and not just supportive peers, but peers who engage in more positive behaviors, is helpful. We know that keeping kids actively involved in a faith-based community can also be very helpful, not just per se for going to church, but keeping kids really actively involved in church, which mm-hmm. also provides alternative outlets for kids. So those are lots of things that can keep kids resilient.
Now, Ivan, in your study, you talk about some of the coping mechanisms that kids are dealing with. I mean, kids are dealing with so much violence in school. I know here in Philadelphia, which is where you're based, you know, West Philadelphia High School was basically kind of separated because the kids were attacking the teachers. Now, what does that exhibit to you, Dr. Blau, that a kid is attacking an adult, a figure of authority, to the point where the teacher's neck was broken? What is that a sign of?
Well, obviously, that's a sign of very serious problems. And you know, we have so much violence and things that, you know, the youngsters are watching today. The kind of impulsivity and you know, dangerous behavior that youngsters exhibit is something that we have to be very cautious about. But I think it's important the audience understands that violence does not equate with, is not consistent with mental health issues or mental illness. Very, very few people that have a mental health condition actually become violent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that what you know, the kind of stressors that you know, we're discussing here that give rise to acting out kinds of behaviors is less than you know, a very small percentage. But those are the kinds of things that we have to look for. The triggers that key into it. You know, are people talking about hurting themselves or hurting other people? Are they looking at, you know, securing weapons or, you know, those sorts of things? And if that happens, then obviously, then, you know, really must be able to act on those.
Now, Ivan, in your study, like you said, you went across this country. So what do you think the difference for African-American youth are in terms of dealing with mental health issues as opposed to, say, you know, white youth or Asian youth or Native American youth?
I think specifically for low-income black youth and for the community in general, it's moving away from a treatment model to a prevention model. But specifically around prevention and protective factors, I mean, one of the things that we see, particularly for low-income black boys, if you want them to thrive versus just survive, it would be asking them, do they have a plan? What are their goals? They're not thinking those in those terms. And that, those, to me, would be the kinds of things we want to know as a prevention strategy versus if they're at the point where they're talking about a gun or if they're talking about doing some other things, then you're almost at you're on the treatment end of the spectrum. So we got to move more towards protective factors. We have to move more towards what the community can do and really how we're connected to kids and kids are connected to us.
Now, what can, you know, we talk about looking for signs. Dr. Malik, you specialize in suicide. That's a very chilling issue for me as a parent. That would be the worst thing for me to come home and find that my child killed herself. Are you guys aware of there's a choking game out that children are doing? And then to some point, there's these suicide packs. Dr. Malik, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, one thing that I want to stress is that these sort of unusual packs or sometimes modeling effects do tend to occur in clusters, and it's more likely to occur in young people, particularly if the behavior gets a lot of notoriety, or sometimes it almost becomes what we call glamorized or romanticized.
Mm-hmm.
And those tend to be more regional. So I was at a suicide conference a few weeks ago, and I had heard about the choking game. And sometimes kids use that as an initiation rite almost, to sort of, not necessarily for a gang per se, but some sense of trying to belong to a particular group, which may or may not be gang-related. And I think one of the things that one of your other experts talked about earlier is, unfortunately, teenagers are more likely to do things impulsively.
Mm.
And so things may not necessarily be thought through, particularly if they're intoxicated or high on some kind of substance. And so the behavior may not be clearly thought through. And unfortunately, if they choose a really lethal method, like hanging or handguns, then the probability that they're going to be actually, it ends up in a fatality is really high. So I think it's really important for parents to look out for signs for that.
Joy, can I jump in real quick here?
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
Pick up on something that, you know, Dr. Malik is saying. I think the audience and you know, suicide is such a tragic issue, and it's the third leading cause of death, you know, in teenagers. And there really are a couple things. You know, if a child or a youth is talking about hurting themselves or killing themselves, if they're writing about it, if they're the feelings of hopelessness and what Dr. Malik said, that risky behavior, if they've withdrawn from friends and families and you know, one of the telltale signs that they've given away, you know, a bunch of possessions and started to talk about hurting, you know, killing themselves, you have to take that seriously and to get help. Now, I represent, you know, I'm with the...
Oh, I think we lost him. Good morning. Dr. Malik, are you still there? Ivan, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, well, I think we lost two calls, but let me keep talking to you about the special research you were doing. One of the things you talked about is that there are not a lot of providers, mental health providers out there that look like African-American. There are not a lot of African-American providers to help these children, and they might feel uncomfortable go talking to, say, a white, a Caucasian provider. Can you talk about that a little bit and what some of the children said?
Yeah, I mean, they said very specifically, you know, they felt more comfortable, because what you're talking about is you're talking about someone you can trust to share, you know, intimate personal information.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, you know, they want folks who look like them and who share their background and experiences. Understanding someone's worldview, how they view the world, is critical to being able to relate and therefore connect and then build trust. So, I mean, this is just basic human psychology for anyone. You know, so if you're coming from a Afrocentric perspective and you can understand my experiences, my worldview, you can really understand racism, for example, and how it's gone from overt to covert. If you can understand those subtleties, you're going to be much more effective in building trust with someone that you're trying to help.
Now, you're going to make are you making a film about this project? There was a film, I understand, yes?
Yeah, there is a film, and the name of the film is Moving Beyond Survival Mode, Promoting Mental Wellness and Resiliency as a Way to Cope with Urban Trauma. And it's a 40-minute documentary that really brings together these voices that we talk to in the community, in addition to some top experts, Dr. Carl Bell and Dr. Joseph White, to talk about, you know, mental health and mental wellness in the Black community and how we have to understand that risk factors aren't predictive factors because of protective factors. We have to really understand as a community that we got to create a common language and framework to kind of educate our communities around the protective factors that enable kids in the lowest income communities to not only survive but thrive versus just get by on urban trauma.
I think Dr. Blau and Dr. Malik have gotten back in. Good morning. Are you Dr. Blau, Dr. Malik?
I am back.
Okay, good. Good. Dr. Blau, go ahead and continue your train of thought there.
Well, I was just talking about this, following up on Dr. Malik's discussion about suicide warnings, and I was going to share that, you know, with the at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, and SAMHSA is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, and we have a national suicide prevention lifeline, and if you're interested, it's 1-800-273-TALK. So what I was wanting to jump in there and talking about that is that, you know, the tragedy of suicide and really the preventable tragedy based on those warning signs that we were discussing, that if somebody is out there and needs to talk to somebody or wants to get more information, 1-800-273-TALK, which is our suicide, the SAMHSA Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So I just wanted to make sure we got that in there.
Oh, that's a wonderful. I think that's one of the main purposes of my shows. If you listen to some other shows, is providing resources to people, and that's why I wanted to have you guys on. One of the important issues, I think, with dealing with mental health is people turn to their religion. And Dr. Malik, you have a master's in divinity. How do you think that helps people with their mental health, and specifically children?
I think it helps a lot. I think one thing, we're trying to develop prevention programs in churches, and one of the reasons we're doing that is we know that African-Americans and some other ethnic minority groups also are less likely to to seek mental health treatment and less likely to have access to it. So one of the things we're trying to do is in a way is sort of bring the mental health treatment to them.
Mm-hmm.
And since historically the African American church has been a place of healing, a source of support. I jokingly call it sort of one-stop shopping. You can kind of get a lot of different needs met in the same place. And a lot of the African-American churches have really active youth ministries. My children went to a revival last night. So it's a really good place for kids to get connected with other kids, to also have access to adult support in a way that's very supportive. And for some parents in this community, getting help in the school system has not been a pleasant experience either. And so the church is a more neutral place and it's a more helpful place. But it's also really important to equip churches with the information that they need so that they can link people to services. And that's what we try to do. So we're not asking church clergy persons or leaders to actually provide treatment because they don't have the training to do that. But what we are asking them to do is to be a conduit or a link or a bridge to
mm-hmm.
treatment. So we're trying to sort of get mental health professionals and the churches together to form kind of a caring community where everyone can kind of do their role and do their part in helping to link kids and families to services.
Well, I think that's really important because, like you said, again, if we go back to the cultural issue, every culture has a different way of dealing with stressors. And Ivan, in your study, you were talking about the young black females, and one of their stressors were relationships. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what we
found. Intimate relationships, I guess.
Yeah, intimate. Well, really, it makes sense if you think about their male counterparts dealing with issues around poverty, violence, survival, many thoughts on any given day, they could be killed. And then from the female perspective, she's the primary caregiver for, in many ways, children that they may have, children she may just have on her own. In many ways, responsible for the parents. But in terms of the intimate relationship, you're talking about, domestic violence, teen dating violence, intimate partner violence, power and control issues, and of course, that's a major stressor.
Oh, definitely. I mean, well, February, if you guys, I'm sure you know, is Teen Dating Violence Month, and I did a show about that, and it just choked me to have to say Teen Dating Violence Month. Let's talk about the issue maybe of bipolar. And also that there are a lot of young black males on SSI now. The rate is rising of boys being on disability, young boys. Dr. Blau, how would you define what is bipolar?
Well, bipolar disorder, historically, people refer to it as manic depression, which is where people cycle from being extremely depressed or sad and, to being extremely manic or agitated and, like lots of energy and things like this. And this back and forth cycle that can be very dangerous both ways, both because if you're on the depression side of that, then you have more likelihood to have problems in functioning or even, feelings of suicide. If you're on the manic side, you have problems with sleep, impulsivity, you can get into lots of different kinds of trouble. And so it manifests itself a little bit differently, in children perhaps than it does in adults. But yet that we've seen a significant increase in the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, over the last many years as people have honed in on what those particular symptoms are. And then the treatment for that, which I think, folks understand, can be a combination of different kinds of talking types of therapy or what we often refer to as cognitive behavior therapy, as well as the need potentially for some kinds of medication.
Now, I think a wonderful thing that you stated earlier was about the issue of violence, because a lot of people, when they hear that someone has a mental health illness, and that's why I played the public service announcement earlier, they kind of pause and then maybe step back and say, in their minds, should I continue my friendship? But that friendships are important, and I think all of you kind of mentioned support being important, but particularly peers being important. And Ivan, I think you talk about that in your study, having peers that they can model after.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, we have to also realize that these are slightly older peers, and in many ways, they're not, they're half a generation older in many cases, but they call them old heads. So mm-hmm. it's folks in the community that they've seen kind of, navigate various issues in terms of police harassment, how to navigate the system, may have had, exposure to the criminal justice system, which is, again, a major stressor in these communities. And they've been there, done that, and kind of can teach them some of those kind of thriving techniques.
Now, Dr. Malik, what do you see for the future of mental health for children? I mean, in terms of schools seem to be really ill-prepared to deal with, say, a serious issue like bipolar or, well, there's a lot of issues with the ADD and ADHD. But what more can schools do? Why are they not putting more funds into having more counselors or more social workers in the school system? What do you think the reason is for that?
Well, I think, unfortunately, when we have cuts in services or when we are in an economic recession like we are right now, social services, not just in school systems, all across the board, tend to go first. So I think part of that, I'm sure the other callers can jump in with this too, is we have to actually value children and think that this is important. We do know that when there are some school systems, including in Maryland, which is the state I live in, that do have some mental health systems or health care systems inside the school. Mm. And we find that when you do that, actually kids are managed really well because, again, you can get health issues there. It reduces some of the stigma because, if, for example, if you're going there to get your ADHD medicine or to have your monitor for depression or bipolar disorder, it's a really kind of benign place to go. Your privacy is protected. And the one place where kids are kind of a captive audience is the school system. The downside to that, though, is that kids who are at most risk for severe mental disorders also may not actually be going to school. So the school system is a good place to locate that, but we have to do more than that.
Dr. Blau, at what point, at what age do maybe most mental illnesses start to appear? Is it in elementary school? Is it in middle school? Where does it start? Or is it that it can start at any point?
Well, the truth is that there's been some studies done by our colleagues at the National Institutes of Mental Health that demonstrate that 50% of mental health, mental illnesses and serious mental health conditions actually start by the age of 14, and that number rises to 75% by the time a person gets to be 24 years old, which means basically that some of these serious problems obviously are starting at young ages, which is why I really liked some of the comments before about the risk, the protective factors, the early intervention that needs to occur, because by providing a youngster with that protective factor, and one of the things that we have found is that having one really caring adult mentor, and it doesn't matter, that could, obviously we want it to be parents, but it could also be a coach, it could be a neighbor, it can be a grandparent, any other relative, whatever, but that one mentor-adult relationship about, really demonstrating caring, it really goes a long way in creating the protective factors that's necessary for better, improved productivity in life. And that's really what I think most of us want for our children, which is to be successful and to have a good life. And that's really the important piece. So focusing on the young age is really critical.
So, and Ivan, in your study, you're talking about, in terms of having role models, talking about the rappers that a lot of kids listen to and the musicians, that maybe they should start speaking about this mental health issue. Can you talk about that a little more?
I think you also want to put, even before rappers, as was mentioned by a previous expert, is parents. I mean, one of the things we found when we did focus groups as a part of this project with the parents of these adolescents, 14 to 17, was we found that they had kind of been through the fires. They had come out the other end. They had to deal with their own mental health issues and kind of came through it, and they can talk to other parents and they can talk to adolescents because they have adolescents. So I would put those even before rappers, because I think it's important that at the end of the day, what really happens in terms of parenting, you don't realize you're doing this, but you're modeling throughout your life for your children how to deal with stress, because you have stressors coming at you too. So the best thing you can do as a parent is teach your children how to deal with stress and manage stress.
Yes. Well, Doc, go ahead.
Especially when we have information that says that if we don't do that at a young age, the trajectory for children, especially children that come from a community of color, and is actually really bad. The Children's Defense Fund did a study a couple of years ago that says one out of every six Latino males born today will end up in prison. And that number doubles. One in three African-American males born today will end up in prison. And if we don't do something now by creating those protective factors, then we're just seeing an entire generation fall through the cracks, which we cannot afford to do.
Well, many people, and one of the people, let me just say real quick, Dr. Malik, one of the people in the chat room brings up the issue of mental illness in prison. Many people, as all of you know, that are in prison have been abused, have addiction issues, so on and so forth. So I think that is a very key point there, that starting young, and that it is the parents' responsibility, like Ivan mentioned, to try to model behaviors. Dr. Malik, go ahead. You had a comment.
Just wanted to jump in there also. This is why, echoing what everyone is saying, prevention is so important because it actually costs us a lot more to treat these issues, either by sending people to prison where they're not getting any treatment at all. People have much more less productivity in the long run. So it's ironic that at the very time when we may be living in more stressful times because parents are more likely to be unemployed or underemployed, and those stressors, those stressful environments trickle down and affect our children, that's the very time you should not cut services. You really need to add more resources to that area because it costs us so much more not to prevent problems than it does to fix them, down the line.
And if the listeners have any interest or concern at all, the idea of going to one's, you know, pastor or reverend or going to a pediatrician and trying to, you know, and ask, is this something that we really need to be concerned about? And if so, are there treatment, you know, areas, locations that we can go to? SAMHSA has actually a treatment locator on our website where you can go to SAMHSA, which is SAMHSA.gov. And at that website, you look there. There's a treatment locator, whether it's substance abuse or mental health issues. You can click on it, click on your state, and get a whole list of possible treatment options that might be available to you in order to get help.
Well, I have your link on my webpage, Dr. Blau. Also, Ivan, I have a link to Me Productions on the website. People want to learn more about Ivan Juzang's film that he's created. And Dr. Malik's information is also on the website. But I believe you're on sabbatical right now, Dr. Malik?
Yeah, but another good resource to go to is NIMH's National Institute of Mental Health website as well. And it's www.nimh.gov. And they also have lots of information about treatments and research about treatment. So that's another good site to go to.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming on this morning. We can continue. We didn't even hit on so many other issues, but I want to thank all of you, Ivan Juzang, Dr. Blau, Dr. Mala, for coming on this morning and talking about this very important issue. Again, remember, parents, please reach out if you see something going on with your children. But also, as a parent, I want to speak to parents that take care of yourself also. That's very important, to take care of yourself and your mental health, which in turn I think will rub off on your children. Thank you so much for coming on this morning, you guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank all the listeners this morning for listening to the show. This was the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I want to let you know you can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keyes. You can also become a fan of the show on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. Stay tuned next Saturday, June 5th. We'll be having actress Keisha Sharp. You know her from the show Girlfriends. You saw her on Why Did I Get Married, the movie. And now she's going to be on Are We There Yet, the TV show. In the second half of next Saturday, we'll be talking with singer Nneka. She's a Nigerian-born singer. She moved to Germany, and now she has a new album out, and she's touring around the world. And she'll be in Philadelphia next Saturday, June 5th. So tune in next Saturday, June 5th, to listen to the show. I want to leave you with some of the song from a soundtrack for a revolution. Singer Anthony Hamilton sang on that song, and I hope you have a wonderful Saturday. Thank you so much.